From the state capitol, the Florida Public Radio Network brings you Capitol Report.
All eyes are on Florida as voters cast ballots in the Republican presidential primary. Governor Rick Scott says you'll just have to keep guessing about his vote.
About six.
I'm not going to talk about who I voted for.
Advocates of early learning say bills before lawmakers could result in a loss of services to thousands of children.
We would have to disenroll in this state approximately 32,000 school-aged children.
Florida's casino gambling debate rages on, and lawmakers try to crack down on repeat drug offenders. I'm Tramell Gomes, and that's all coming up on Capitol Report. Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney held a comfortable double-digit lead in polls over struggling rival Newt Gingrich as Florida's Republican voters cast ballots today in the high-stakes presidential primary election.
I hope everybody, I guess you have to be registered as a Republican, but hopefully everybody gets out to vote. I guess around the state there's other things on the ballot.
Florida Governor Rick Scott cast his ballot bright and early this morning. Governor Scott's Tallahassee voting precinct is the Lincoln Neighborhood Center, just a few blocks west of the mansion. After slipping that ballot into the optical scan machine, reporters wanted to know who he voted for in the presidential primary.
I told somebody I'm ready this morning. I think it had less than 10 letters in the last name. I was trying to think of some way to say it where everybody would be in.
So the reporters persisted. How many letters? Maybe fewer than eight?
About six.
I'm not going to talk about who I voted for.
Governor Scott refused to pick a favorite between frontrunners Mitt Romney and Newt Gingrich. Former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum and Texas Representative Ron Paul didn't spend much time campaigning in the state. Florida Secretary of State Kurt Browning says everything is going smoothly so far, but there was a slight hiccup in Orlando when a polling place opened late.
The only situation that had voters affected were these two voters in Orange County, Orlando. It's not a big deal. It happens all the time. My concern would have been if those two voters would not have been able to cast the ballot.
Browning says the Orange County Supervisor of Elections and poll workers took care of the situation appropriately by allowing people to vote in a parking lot. The state's elections chief has mixed emotions over his last election. Browning is retiring again about 2 weeks after today's presidential primary. He's been working elections at the state and local level for 36 years. Browning says he'll miss the job, but being away from his family in Pasco County for the last 5 years has been difficult. A series of bills changing the way Florida's early learning programs are run is moving through the legislature. The measures attempt to address problems raised from an audit that detailed fraud and waste in the system. But as Lynn Hatter reports, some advocates of early learning say the bills could reduce those programs to little more than glorified babysitting services.
Early in the legislative session, legislators heard a report from the state auditor general that found disparities in how providers are paid, with some getting more money than they should and others getting less. The audit also found more than 16,000 people received $40 million in school readiness benefits they weren't eligible for. Many of those cases are under investigation, and some have already been declared as fraud.
When you're looking at over $30 million of fraud, concerns are just naturally raised.
Several bills moving through the legislature attempt to address the audit findings. One, by Republican Representative Marty Coley, tries to solve the reimbursement issue. Her bill would standardize provider reimbursement rates across the state and cap the amount of money that early learning coalitions can spend on administrative tasks. Coley says standardizing reimbursement rates is a logical step for the state to take.
It does prioritize who should be served first, what ages, income level, whether it's a child who has been neglected or abandoned or abused. So it does look at the child, and it opens up slots to serve more children.
You know, a standard statewide rate we're not especially concerned about. What we are concerned about is that there are changes that go along with that that have to do with the eligibility guidelines. We would have to disenroll in this state approximately 32,000 school-age children.
Alisa Gazzavini is with the Association of Early Learning Coalitions, which are against Coley's bill. That's because current school readiness program funds can go to children up to 13, and the money can be used for after-school program funds. Coley's bill reduces the age to 5 so that the money would only cover early learning programs. Coley says she knows the age limits are restrictive and will be offering amendments to restore some of the eligibility requirements. Gazzavini says Coley's bill isn't all bad and that as far as early learning proposals go, it's one of the lesser of several evils. What the early learning coalitions are really concerned about is a bill before the House's K-20 Competitiveness Subcommittee. It allows private providers to choose a different curriculum other than what has been approved by the state. It lets them also create their own plan. And those same providers could choose to opt out of the mandatory development screenings currently in place. That doesn't sit well with Kathleen Reynolds, who heads the Early Learning Coalition of Southwest Florida.
To eliminate this, I'm sorry, is insanity. I can tell you the numbers that we also do hearing and vision screening. We've identified large numbers of kids with serious vision problems, and we're able to get them taken care of. They get glasses so they can actually see what's going on.
The screening tests help identify where a child is struggling and could use some extra help, and they are sometimes the first indicators of a learning disability. Backing the bill is the Florida Association of Child Care Management. It's a private nonprofit organization representing early learning and child care owners across the state. Providers would stand to benefit from the bill because it relaxes many of the reporting requirements in place. But not all providers are in agreement that the bill is the best way to go. Amy Bleckman is a faith-based provider in Martin County, and she says easier doesn't always mean quality.
And if we remove all of that, what we're diminishing ourselves to is nothing more than a child care babysitting program.
House Republican Representative Larry Ahern of St. Petersburg presented a strike-all amendment to the bill, giving the Office of Early Learning the ability to adopt pre- and post-tests to all children in school readiness programs. Ahern describes the move as a way to streamline regulations on the providers.
The bill removes unnecessary business regulations on child care providers by setting provider requirements clearly in statute.
But the curriculum opt-out language, along with the optional screenings, are still a part of the new version of the bill. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report, as a plan to privatize prisons reached the Senate floor today, opponents of the move say they're going to keep fighting.
We want to sell our prisons and our prisoners to the highest bidder. You can count me out. You can count the people of Palm Beach County out. We will never go along with the privatization of our prisons.
A casino gambling debate is the main course at a Capitol Tiger Bay Club luncheon.
Come to Florida, where the largest casinos in the world are. That changes our brand forever.
Lawmakers say the state's drug dealers are getting smarter. A bill moving through the House is aimed at stopping those who figured out how to get around some of the rules.
And they figured out that if you just step off property onto the city sidewalk, the criminal event doesn't happen on property, so it's not included in any nuisance abatement ordinances.
And the debate heats up over injuries in high school sports. The question as to whether to privatize about 30 South Florida prisons took center stage in the Florida Senate today. As Sasha Cordner reports, in a last-ditch effort to stall the effort, several Democrats, Republicans, and state employees joined together to talk about the overall impact the move will have on the state.
Our government is not for sale, and neither are our prisoners for sale.
Right.
Yeah. We all stand together.
Just before the Senate met, Democratic Senator Maria Sachs of Delray Beach got a crowd of correctional officers, teachers, and sheriff's deputies fired up as she vowed that she would fight the massive prison privatization effort.
The corrections officers put their lives and their safety on the line to protect the prisoners and also to protect the safety of our people. And we want to sell this out to the highest bidder as long as we have citizens who hear about this and know that we want to sell our prisons and our prisoners to the highest bidder. You can count me out. You can count the people of Palm Beach County out. We will never go along with the privatization of our prisons.
Prison privatization proponents say privatizing the prisons in South Florida could save the state between $22 and $45 million. And that savings would go towards areas like education. But KT Caldwell, a math teacher in Seminole County, says prison privatization should not go forward. She says if it does, she's afraid it would set a dangerous precedent.
It seems like the Florida legislature is back to its old tricks. SB 2038 is being rushed through by Governor Rick Scott and extremists in the legislature in an attempt to trample on every Floridian's right to participate in our democracy. It's a democracy that's for the people and by the people. As we privatize industry and the prisons, schools are next.
While on the Senate floor, questions over Senate Bill 2038 turned into more of a grilling session from lawmakers, both Republicans and Democrats alike. Their questions were reserved for Senate Budget Chief J.D. Alexander and Republican Senator John Thrasher, the two chairmen who saw the bill in their committees. They're also both proponents of prison privatization. Republican Senator Mike Fasano, who's against the effort, asked for specifics on how much the state is expected to save.
What is the savings? What, $17, $18 million, maybe less than that? And then you take out the payouts that we're going to have to make to the correctional office that don't stay in the state system. We actually, the taxpayers, could actually lose money the first year if this privatization goes into effect.
Throughout the Senate session, both Thrasher and Alexander maintained there would be a savings to the state. Thrasher says the payouts that Fasano was talking about is a one-time deal, and the savings overall would be recurring, which would be to the benefit of taxpayers.
You know, I don't know what $18 million translates into in terms of the number of teachers we could hire or other types of folks, Senator Fasano, but I got to believe $18 million recurring over a long period of time is going to add up to a lot of savings among the taxpayers. And the 7% that everybody seems to keep missing that is a required savings.
Later, the bill was changed to disallow the privatization of executions or the death penalty. About half of the amendments filed were adopted, but Senator Fasano's amendments were pushed over to Wednesday's floor session, where a vote is expected. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
The Florida casino gambling debate rages on, not just at the state capitol, but also on the luncheon speaker circuit. Tom Flanagan reports hundreds of Capital Tiger Bay Club members were treated to a casino pro and con showdown.
Prominent Tallahassee lobbyist Nick Iorossi spoke in favor of the bills allowing destination resorts in Florida. Not surprising, as his client is the Las Vegas Sands Corporation. It presently operates casinos in Las Vegas, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, China, and Singapore. As a result of destination gaming, Iorossi says far more large-scale meetings and conventions are happening in those places. The same, he says, could happen in South Florida.
Miami actually ranks 41st in the number of conventions and trade show attendees, which for an international city and a city that has all the entertainment offerings and hotel infrastructure, there's really no excuse for that, except for they do not have a destination-type resort, and they're having to compete with places like Las Vegas, like New York, like Chicago.
But the meeting and convention business, while very important to Florida's overall hospitality industry, pales in comparison to the state's regular tourist traffic. Mark Wilson, president and CEO of the Florida Chamber of Commerce, says that's the market that would be most at risk if destination resorts are built.
Our concern, quite frankly, is that once you change a brand, it's changed forever. Once you allow these companies to invest tens of millions of dollars advertising the following, come to Florida where the largest casinos in the world are. That changes our brand forever. And all of a sudden, what does that do to the mix of who's coming to Florida now? What does that do to our small businesses?
Of course, casino proponents say that increasing business is the main rationale for building casinos in the first place. Iorossi says the economic upside will be dramatic and immediate.
This proposal can create tens of thousands of jobs. Some state economists in Florida estimate up to 100,000 new jobs are created by three destination resorts and the $6 billion in capital infusion that it would create.
Casino opponent Wilson says Iorossi is looking at the wrong numbers.
The gambling interests had put out a study a few years ago, and they talked about the benefits of it, and they said this will work except in fine print in places like Florida where there's already an established tourism market. And that came from the gambling industry's own study.
Iorossi insists destination resorts would simply build upon what already makes Florida an attractive place.
Florida is a wonderful place to come see because of the beaches. It's a wonderful place to come see because of Orlando and the tourist attractions that we have throughout. This is one spoke in the entertainment wheel that will help drive new visitation to help those businesses, both in the hotel and restaurant industry, and the surrounding businesses that would service these destination resorts.
But the Chamber's Mark Wilson begs to differ. He cites the experience of Atlantic City, New Jersey. It was a very popular tourist destination long before the arrival of the casinos, beginning in the late 1970s. Since then, Wilson says it's been all downhill for non-casino businesses in that town.
40% of restaurants and hotels in the first year, 40% of all the restaurants and hotels in Atlantic City closed down within 1 year of the casino opening. 40%. One-third of all of the retail establishments closed their doors after 1 year of the casino being open.
And so on, back and forth for the better part of an hour. There are other considerations in the casino debate as well, such as which of two competing bills might gain more traction in the legislature. One would authorize up to three destination resorts only in Dade and Broward counties. The other would allow such resorts in any county whose voters agreed to have them. Then there's the matter of how this might affect the Seminole Gaming Compact, which gives the tribe the exclusive right to certain casino-style games for another 2 years. And finally, in an election year, there's the question of how many lawmakers may want to jump into an issue that could be a losing proposition no matter how they play their cards. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Tom Flanagan.
You're listening to Capitol Report on the Florida Public Radio Network. I'm Tramell Gomes. Florida lawmakers are considering a measure that would help officials to crack down on repeat drug offenders. Regan McCarthy reports the measure would expand the definition of a public nuisance.
Representative Jim Frisch says Florida's drug dealers are getting smarter.
And they figured out that if you just step off property onto the city sidewalk, the criminal event doesn't happen on property, so it's not included in any nuisance abatement ordinances.
Frisch, a Republican from Bel Air Bluffs, is the author of a bill, House Bill 1443, that would expand the definition of public nuisance to include any place where more than twice in 6 months controlled substances are stored for the purpose of being sold or delivered. Frisch says his bill will help to fight crime.
And it gives the cities another tool to deal with not only drug but gang-related violence.
St. Petersburg Republican Representative Jeff Brandis says he's been approached about bringing a similar bill forward before, but he hasn't. He says that's because he's worried the bill could accidentally ensnare an innocent person. For example, someone who owns a hotel.
I have an obligation, to my knowledge, to rent to pretty much anybody who comes in the door without discrimination. If my location has been cited as a nuisance prior to this, and then I rent a room to somebody, and then they've now gone and found drugs in that room, and I did not knowingly sit rent to somebody, it seems like I could be kind of brought up before the board for a violation.
Brandis says he supports the measure, but would like to see what he calls a knowingly and willingly provision in the measure. Frisch says he thinks the proposal already takes care of that. He says the bill stipulates that officials would work to ensure the owner of the property is aware of the situation. But he says owners need to be more than bystanders who are collecting rental fees. They need to take some responsibility for the situation.
You have an obligation to keep illegal activity outside of your business because you control your business, in theory. And we expect owners to maintain some control. If you're willing to rent repeatedly to people who are dealing drugs out of your hotel, then you probably have bigger problems than just the nuisance board, quite frankly. But this gives the city an opportunity to use the nuisance ordinances to help you control that also.
Representative Mark Pafford, a Democrat from West Palm Beach, says he's considered similar issues, like what the impact might be on parents if their teenager is caught a few times storing illicit substances in his room. But Pafford says he feels confident the bill protects people in those kinds of situations and focuses on drug traffickers instead. He says the measure is a tool he knows from experience that law enforcement officers could really benefit from.
I live in a neighborhood that's loaded with rental homes, and since I've been in that neighborhood, there have been at least a half a dozen drug busts. And no matter how many times I called the sheriff, they really couldn't do anything.
Pafford says he's convinced this bill will help. Frisch says local governments must first have their own local nuisance ordinances in place before the provisions in this bill can be enforced. The bill passed through the House Community and Military Affairs Subcommittee. A similar bill in the Senate has not yet been taken up. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Here's Ronald J. Eben with a look at some of the action around the Capitol tomorrow.
The full Senate Budget Committee meets Wednesday at 9 a.m., but with no budget allocation yet, the committee still doesn't have a spending plan to work through. The Senate Criminal and Civil Justice Committee will consider a constitutional change that would allow judges and justices to remain on the bench until the age of 75. The current limit is 70. The Senate will be in session at 1:30 to take up prison privatization and school prayer, among other issues. Final action on a Senate bill that would require the members of the public to be given a reasonable opportunity to be heard before a board or commission is expected before the Senate Government Oversight Committee. And the full House Appropriations Committee is scheduled to consider the budget, increasing the pressure on the Senate to move more quickly on its spending plan. And that's the day book for Wednesday, February 1st.
A Senate committee has reworked a proposal regarding head injuries in public school student athletes. James Call reports lawmakers decided to allow the High School Athletic Association to develop rules on when a student who suffers a concussion can resume competition.
The issue of concussions is a hot-button topic. Nationwide, studies indicate more than 60,000 concussions occur every year among high school-age students. Venice Senator Nancy Dietert's sons were high school athletes, and now her granddaughters compete.
And it's not just football. I've got four granddaughters who are all cheerleaders, and they throw those kids up two stories high, and I'm like, is somebody going to catch her? Just because she's small doesn't mean she can go up several stories, but... It does kind of scare you, but...
A concussion is caused by a violent blow to the head. It can produce a variety of cognitive, emotional, and physical symptoms affecting memory, judgment, and balance. An injury to NHL star Sidney Crosby and a lawsuit filed by retired NFL players have brought a lot of attention to sports-related head injuries. In the past 2 years, 31 states have passed laws setting uniform standards for dealing with concussions in public schools.
Well, I guess 31 other states don't have the same battles going between chiros and doctors.
Fort Lauderdale Senator Jeremy Ring's efforts to set a protocol to deal with head injuries were blocked last year. This session, he is working to prevent derailment of a similar proposal by Miami Senator Anatir Flores. The stumbling block is, who gets to say that a youth who suffered a concussion is well enough to resume play? Should it be someone qualified in the field of neurology? Or someone who received neurological training.
But this is the time where the legislature's just got to say, we'll make the decision. You know, we're in the position, we'll make the decision. Either one group will be unhappy or both groups will be unhappy. Because I don't know if there's a way to do it to make all groups happy. Other than what we need to do, which is to make the kids safe. And that's our number one position, not making one group happy or another.
Lawmakers have balked at putting the decision in the hands of certified neurologists. They fear it would be a hardship for student athletes. Ring notes that there are no practicing physicians in Liberty County and wonders if there is a neurologist within 100 miles of the county seat, Bristol. Dr. Timothy McQuinney is a Palm Beach chiropractor, and he batted away assertions from neurologists that chiropractors lack the expertise to clear a head injury patient to play. McQueenie is the team doctor for two high school football teams.
I'm the one doing their preseason physicals. I'm the one who has the relationships with these kids. I'm the one treating the sprained ankles, the knee injuries, the back injuries, whatever else they may come in with. And I've also made the hard decisions to pull these kids out of games when they've had concussion injuries. I've made the hard decisions to keep them out of games for several weeks if appropriate.
The president of the Florida Society of Neurology told lawmakers only medical doctors and osteopathic doctors are uniquely qualified to examine the eyes and clear patients for competition. The Florida Medical Association is tentatively supporting a possible compromise. Spokesperson Rebecca O'Hara told the committee the group is still studying the language, but a proposal to allow the Florida High School Athletic Association to develop rules on who determines when a head injury patient resumes play may be acceptable.
I think that if we can continue to work on that language to ensure that the person who is making the decision to return the athlete to play is in fact appropriately qualified, but continue to leave that definition in the hands of the High School Athletic Association, that may be a place where we can get some middle ground.
The bill emerging in the Senate would require the Florida High School Athletic Association to develop guidelines for educating coaches, players, parents, and officials about sports-related head injuries, require a student athlete suspected of a concussion to be removed from the game, and prohibit the student from returning to practice or competition until the youth receives written clearance from someone qualified in the field of neurology, the qualifications to be determined by the High School Athletic Association. Committee members voted to make the proposal a committee substitute and sent it to its next stop, the Budget Committee. A similar proposal is working its way through the House. For Florida Public Radio, I'm James Call.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are James Call, Sasha Cordner, Tom Flanagan, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to the contributing stations along the Florida Public Radio Network. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance for Capitol Report, and I'm Tremel Gomes, inviting you to join us each weeknight for more reports from the state capitol.